The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back. Happy Tuesday, March 27th, 2018. This is the Seth and Chris Show. I am Seth Leibson. Our phone number is 602-508-0960. A lot to do today. Speaking of Tuesday, Bill, it's interesting, isn't it? In a workplace environment, or really anywhere, people will say, kind of feels like a Monday, or kind of feels like a Friday. No one ever says it feels like a Tuesday. Tuesday doesn't have its own feel, does it? It's kind of an oddly placed day in the week. I mean, an oddly described day in the week. There's no description for a Tuesday. Maybe on Thursday I'll say feels like a Tuesday and see what happens, what kind of audience reaction we get. I give you good news. I have good news for you. You're a fan of you cannot act like Vera or the guy in Tool Time where you don't talk and people wonder if you exist. Turn on the mic, converse.
All right, Norm Peterson, I'm here.
Yeah, you can't act like the person who no one knows if they really exist or not. Because this is about you. I bring you good news.
This affects all of us, man.
Well, it affects you. HBO has a documentary coming out in a couple of weeks on none other than Andre the Giant, the actor and professional wrestler, whom I know you like professional wrestling.
Sure do.
Aren't you excited about this? He was an actor, too, of sorts. He was in The Princess Bride, I think most famously. He was in that 1976 episode of The $6 Million Man, where he played Sasquatch. He played Bigfoot. Which is interesting because Andre the Giant was listed at being 7'5". Why is that interesting? That famous Patterson-Gimlin film that is so disputed that comes out of Northern California upon analysis by everyone who's analyzed it says it's a 7'5" creature. I think that's just interesting. I'll leave it at that. I'll just leave it at that. Okay, there is a lot to do today on other fronts. Just a couple of cultural observations. The importance of the judiciary and picking the right judges. The importance of picking the right president to appoint those judges and Supreme Court justices. It's an op-ed in the New York Times today that's really disturbing. For those who have thought, well, you know, all these protests and protesters regarding the Parkland, Florida massacre, they don't really want to get rid of the Second Amendment. Well, the bark was stripped bare off that tree today with an op-ed by none other than a former justice of the United States Supreme Court, John Paul Stevens, age 97, by the way, asking us to do away by constitutional amendment with the Second Amendment. Literally writing that overturning the decision, he's talking about the Heller decision, via a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Second Amendment would be simple and would do more to weaken the NRA's ability to stymie legislative debate and block constructive gun control legislation than any other viable or available option. Direct advocacy for doing away with the Second Amendment. That's what John Paul Stevens is advocating. It will never happen. But may I say a few things about this? For those who may not recall, John Paul Stevens was appointed by a Republican to the Supreme Court in the 1970s, 1975 or 6, by Gerald Ford. By Gerald Ford. For those that lament a certain Republican Party of the East Coast variety, even though Ford was from Michigan, or of the moderate variety, this is what you get. You get John Paul Stevens's, and you get Gerald Ford's. I had occasion yesterday to recall one of the great authors of the 20th century, one of the people who brought to bear the full enormity of the Soviet Union, was Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Soviet dissident who moved to America. And the Ford White House refused. He wanted to meet with the president. One thought it might be a good idea going into the negotiations with the Soviets for President Ford to meet one of the most famous Soviet dissidents of all time. Ford and Henry Kissinger vetoed that idea. Solzhenitsyn did not go to the White House of Gerry Ford's. They turned down the invitation, the White House did. You know who took up the invitation? It's kind of a funny thing to say. Harvard University. In 1978, Alexander Solzhenitsyn gave one of the most famous commencement speeches of all time. And he gave it at Harvard University. 1978. It's a speech still worth reading. It's about the courage, lack of courage in defending the West. It's about truth and self-evident truths. Harvard had more courage, if you will, than the Republican White House, and it wouldn't have taken much courage to meet with a Soviet dissident. Well, anyway, it's that same White House that gave us John Paul Stevens, okay, who ended up being one of the more liberal members of the Supreme Court. Did it faze Gerald Ford? It did not. It did not. As late as 2005, in his retirement, Gerry Ford said of Stevens, who was still serving in 2005, Stevens is serving his nation well, with dignity, intellect, and without partisan political concerns. Ha! Ha! He ended up being one of the more liberal members of the Supreme Court, betraying the notion of a strict constructionist, betraying the notion of what Republicans usually seek.
That's a laugh, Mrs. Robinson. That's really a laugh.
Thank you. Yes, it's a laugh, and it's a real laugh. Now, for those that think the Supreme Court should be above politics and the, if you will, vicissitudes of the day, the political pressures of the day, Supreme Court should be strictly interested in the law and in constitutional original understandings, Stevens gives lie to that in his op-ed in the New York Times today. Listen to how he opens. Listen to how he opens. Rarely in my lifetime have I seen the type of civic engagement school children and their supporters demonstrated in Washington and other major cities throughout the country this past Saturday. These demonstrations demand our respect. They reveal the broad public support for legislation. So based on the marches that took place over the weekend by these children, former Justice John Paul Stevens is praising them and saying, rarely in my lifetime have I seen this type of civic engagement. Where has he been? March for Life, anyone? Takes place in Washington every year, and it gets a lot more people than this weekend got from children. In fact, I have been in Washington many a time during the March for Life. I was actually in Washington when it took place this year. And it gets, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, anywhere from 400,000 to 700,000 people. 400,000 to 700,000 people. And a lot of them are children, by the way. A lot of them are children. Now, John Paul Stevens happens to be happens to be pro-choice. So is it not a little odd that he would say, rarely in my lifetime have I seen the type of civic engagement school children and their supporters demonstrated in Washington and other major cities throughout the country this past Saturday? Where has he been when it came to the March for Life? Remember the church lady? How inconvenient. We need that. Dana Carvey, how inconvenient. How inconvenient that he would just put blinders on something that doesn't take place once and is over, as I think this march over the last weekend will be, I think it's going to be a one-off. But how about every year, 400 to 700,000 attendees?
How convenient.
Yeah, that's close. We can tighten it or expand it. I am flabbergasted that he gets to say this and hold his head high. Rarely in my lifetime have I seen the type of civic engagement. The March for Life, every year, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. This one-off once, and it gets his attention in order to what? Get rid of a constitutional amendment. We have forgotten a lot of basics here, folks, a lot. And I think it's important we get back to them. See if we got Eugene Volokh on this when we come back. I'm Seth. Our number 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. So, a Republican appointee to the Supreme Court, now retired but still alive and writing, named John Paul Stevens, pens an op-ed in the New York Times today calling for the abolition of the Second Amendment. Good work, Republican Party of Gerald Ford. He says it's unconstitutional in and of itself, the Heller decision, and that the Second Amendment has outlived its usefulness. John Paul Stevens was an antitrust lawyer, should have really never been appointed to the Supreme Court, in my opinion. But thus he was, and thus he became a very liberal member of the Supreme Court. Okay, fine. I'll tell you who'd make a fine appointment to the Supreme Court. One of the most brilliant jurists of our age. He's a professor at UCLA named Eugene Volokh, V-O-L-O-K-H. This kid is smart. I've known him many years. At 10 years of old age, English, by the way, is his second language. He's born in Russia. At 10 years of age, he got a 780 on the math portion of his SAT. At 10. At 15, he graduated UCLA with a degree in, with a Bachelor of Science degree in math and computer science. Pretty impressive guy. He's written a lot of books, including a textbook on con law. Prager University asked him to talk about why the Second Amendment is indeed a personal right, why it is a constitutionally protected personal right. Maybe John Paul Stevens could learn something. I think it's worth all of us hearing Professor Volokh on this. Go ahead.
Does an American citizen have a constitutional right to own a gun? Here's what the Second Amendment says. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. Now, it once seemed to me like that language only protected state militias and not individuals. Indeed, this is the view held by the four dissenting Supreme Court justices in the 2008 case of District of Columbia versus Heller, a landmark case dealing with gun ownership. But the more research I did, the more I came to realize that my initial view was mistaken, and that the founders were in fact securing an individual right. The five justices who voted to affirm the right to own a gun in D.C. versus Heller had indeed made the correct decision. Let's look at the amendment one more time. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. We first need to focus on the phrase, the right of the people. Note that the people are the only ones whose right is secured here, not the militia or a state government. This phrase, the right of the people, comes up a few times in the Constitution. For example, the First Amendment refers to the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government. And the Fourth Amendment secures the right of the people to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures. Why then, if the authors of the Constitution felt so strongly about the right of the people to own guns, did they include language about a well-regulated militia? These opening words of the amendment might be called a justification clause. Such clauses are used to help explain why a right is being secured. But it's the operative clause that explains what right is being secured. In this case, the right of the people to keep and bear arms. And what was the word militia understood to mean at the time? Well, the Militia Act of 1792 defined militia to mean all white males 18 to 45. Today, of course, militia would include women and people of all races. But it was clearly not a reference to a small National Guard-type group. And what about the part of the amendment that says a militia is necessary to the security of a free state? What, the opponents of personal gun ownership ask, does a personal right of gun ownership have to do with that? Again, historical context is key. In the 1790s, the phrase free state wasn't used to mean an individual state like New York or Rhode Island. Rather, it meant what we'd call today a free country, a nation free of despotism. A free state is what the framers wanted America to be. They saw an armed citizenry as in part a hedge against tyranny. Citizens who own weapons can protect themselves, prevent tyrants from seizing power, and protect the nation from foreign enemies. This does not mean, though, that this right is unlimited. Free speech, for example, has long been subject to some narrow and reasonable regulations. But severe restrictions on owning a gun, like severe restrictions on free speech, would violate the Second Amendment as the founders understood it. Maybe you think this understanding of the Second Amendment is outdated today, that the Constitution needs to change as public attitudes change. The founders included a provision for doing just that. If the public attitude really has changed, the Constitution can be amended to reflect that change. But ironically, even if we focus on current public attitudes, the case for individual gun ownership is as strong as ever. Polls consistently show that over two-thirds of Americans believe that the Second Amendment secures the right of citizens to own a gun. And Congress and state governments have repeatedly reaffirmed this view, including in recent decades. So, does the Second Amendment secure an individual right to bear arms? It did when it was written, it has throughout American history, and it does today. I'm Eugene Volokh, professor of law at UCLA for Prager University.
Well, that couldn't be clearer, it couldn't be more simple, and it couldn't instruct better on the phraseology in the Second Amendment, which seems to be confusing only to those who want to do away with the Second Amendment. It's an interesting thing, isn't it, that we're supposed to take the words of those who want to do away with something as the actual intent and words of those that are there. Why don't we read those words by the lights of what the founders meant? And why don't we read those words by the lights of those who actually think this amendment means something to those who exercise those rights? You know, it's a funny thing. Alice in Wonderland ethics. Words mean what I say they mean. Humpty Dumpty and Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass. But this is make no mistake about it. This is the effort of modern liberalism. John Paul Stevens being the most clear on that. I was going to say the left, but John Paul Stevens is a former Supreme Court justice, and I don't think rightfully qualifies as left. This is liberalism today. This is the modern liberal. Do away with the Second Amendment. I could say the universities are governed more by leftists than liberals. They want to do away with the First Amendment. Pretty soon we're going to be rid of our constitutional protections and guarantees if we continue to go down this road that the liberals and the leftists are etching out for us. There is a method, as Eugene Volokh puts it in that short PragerU clip, to amend the Constitution. It is within the Constitution itself. There are a few ways to do it. None of them include big marches by young kids. None of them do. That's my thought on this. Going to be surprised as to what John McCain is up to lately. Some breaking news on that. Dennis Prager has a new book out, which I think could be a bestseller. We're going to talk about that and a lot more things coming right up. 602-508-0960 is the number. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth and Chris Show. I am Seth Leibson, delighted to welcome back our good friend John Dombrowski from Grand Canyon Planning Associates. You can follow him at grandcanyonplanning.com for our regular economy and culture segment. John, how are you?
Market had a little ride today, huh?
Yeah, it did. It had a little bit of a ride today, and I'm thinking we have to blame the tech stocks a little bit here, do we not?
Yeah, I mean, if you looked at yesterday's rally, tech did really well coming back on Monday. Here we are Tuesday, tech rolling over, and a lot of it seems to be attributed to Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
If we are reading between the lines here, regulation may be something that we might be seeing for a lot of these companies who are gathering information on us. What are they doing with that information? How is it being, you know, distributed? And once it's distributed, how is that then being used after that? And are we as consumers ourselves really being told what is going to happen with that information that they're collecting on us? And Facebook, that seems to be the issue.
Facebook is paying a heavy price internally for all these problems, too. It's lost something like $80 billion in the last
Over the last few weeks. Yeah, it's lost 20% of its value.
Yeah.
But with that being said, there are a lot of tech companies out there, Seth, that have much higher multiples or price to earnings ratios than a Facebook does, and companies out there that aren't even earning a profit, and Facebook is.
Okay, that's a fair point for Facebook.
So I'm not saying right or wrong what Facebook is doing, but I'm saying from an investment standpoint, for those out there who may be holding the company, and I'm not making any recommendations one way or another, but if you look at the company itself, they're going to be reporting earnings coming up soon. And the expectation is that they're going to do very well with their earnings. Moving forward, though, however, the forward view at this point, well, that's something that's going to have to be looked at closer to see if that's something that's going to still hold up, or would there be a revision of what the expectation of this company is going to be moving forward.
You mentioned regulations. That kind of legislation going forward will certainly affect stock price, as will, too, any effort to subpoena Mark Zuckerberg to testify before Congress, which I imagine it will be very imminent.
And it may not even necessarily be a subpoena. There might be ask him to come, and he may.
Yeah.
We're just going to have to wait and see. I think that that's certainly something he should do, though.
Oh, yes.
He needs to
answer some questions.
He certainly does, and needs to bring the entourage of people that he needs to in order to support him alongside him. But this is something that most likely is going to have to be done.
I agree with that. There was a question I posed to you yesterday, and I didn't know if you might want to touch on it a little bit today. We can do it if you want. And it was a question I asked you. You could look at someone like Mark Zuckerberg, not exactly him, but there are some people that do want to retire early. You're a retirement planner. You help people with their retirements. Some people may not want to wait to their 60s or so on or further to retire. Can you help with that a little bit?
Yeah. So
it's harder, right?
Of course it is. The younger you are, the more you have to beware of. You've got contingencies and costs that you may not have if you wait until the traditional full retirement age, which many wait until they're the age of 65. Why? Because Medicare is a big part. Health insurance is a big part of retirement costs, and Medicare certainly can limit some of those costs that you may have if you had your own personal insurance plan. But just some statistics out there, Seth, and this is from the Employee Benefit Research Institute.
Yeah.
And this is a confidence survey, and this was as of March of 2017, which we should hopefully have a new one soon. But 6 out of 10 American workers felt then very or somewhat confident about having enough money for a comfortable retirement, and just 18% felt very comfortable. In addition, lacking confidence, there were 3 in 10 workers report that preparing for retirement caused them to feel either mentally or emotionally stressed.
Hmm.
And I can understand that because when you're talking about your money, it's personal to you. And so that's a concern. Workers who have a retirement plan, whether a defined benefit plan or a defined contribution plan, and we can talk about what the differences are of those in another show, but basic retirement plans felt confident. However, those retiring before the age of 59, there's where we have some challenges. Those under that age of 60, they're faced with a lot of expenses that they have to bear on themselves, and you have to be cautious of that. Maybe we'll continue this tomorrow.
Yeah, I'd love to. There's a lot that it brings up, including public policy decisions about raising Medicare and Social Security ages. They're not the same, interestingly enough.
That is correct. They are not.
All right, I'll let you say a word here, buddy.
Okay, securities and advisory services offered through Client One Securities LLC, a member of FINRA and SIPC, and an investment advisor, Grand Canyon Planning Associates LLC, and Client One Securities LLC are not affiliated. Send me an email to dearjohn@grandcanyonplanning.com if you have a question.
Bless you, sir.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Seth and Chris Show. I'm Seth Leibson. Our phone number is 602-508-0960. I want to put in I was mentioning PragerU a few moments ago. want to put in a plug. I just got an advanced copy of Dennis Prager's new book, The Rational Bible. It looks great. It is beautifully produced. And the subtitle is Exodus, God, Slavery, and Freedom. It is it's a massive amount of learning. Oh, my gosh. I guess it comes out officially in the next week or so. I think I want to say April 2nd is the pub date. But fantastic job, Dennis. Folks can, of course, order it online ahead of time.
April 2nd comes out.
It's called The Rational Bible, Exodus, God, Slavery, and Freedom. Interesting. I just opened a random page just to give you a flavor of what you get in here. There's a lot in here. It's broken up, though, in a way that you can really read it very nicely. It's got essays. It's got all by Dennis. A commentary on various parts of the book of Exodus. It's just really well done. It's a really very, I mean this in a secular, in a ecclesiastical sense, a very Talmudic treatment. Funny enough, it's a book of Exodus, and in the dedication to his wife, he quotes Genesis. Nice try. We're on to him. We're on to him. What does he quote in Genesis? It's not good for man to be alone. I will make him a helper who is his equal. That is the literal translation. We're going to have Dennis on to talk about this. Of course we will. But just to give you a small sense of it, this is fabulous. I just cracked open page 264, 20.13 on You Shall Not Steal. The eighth commandment, do not steal, is unique in that it encompasses all the other commandments on the second tablet. Murder is the stealing of another person's life. Adultery is the stealing of another person's spouse. Giving false testimony is stealing justice, and coveting is the desire to steal what belongs to another person. This commandment is unique in another way. It is the only completely open-ended commandment. All the other commandments are specific. The fifth commandment, for example, states whom one must honor, one's parents. The sixth commandment, prohibiting murder, is only about taking the life of an innocent human being. The seventh commandment, prohibiting adultery, is also specific to a married person. Two unmarried people cannot actually commit adultery in the literal sense. But the commandment against stealing doesn't even hint at what it is we are forbidden to steal. It means we cannot take anything that belongs to another human being. Not just a little sample of many I could have picked from. I just thought it fascinating. And actually, I never thought of it that way. Never thought of the commandment not to steal that way. So kudos to Dennis. And if you want a copy of that book, you can order it. I bet you get it by pub date if you order it today. Dennis Prager, The Rational Bible, Exodus, God, Slavery, and Freedom. Well done, sir. I mentioned that John McCain is up to something new, and he sure is. He has a book out coming out. He has a new book coming out. According to Yahoo News, McCain to release no holds barred verdict on Trump. Veteran U.S. Senator John McCain is to deliver a no holds barred verdict on his fellow Republican Donald Trump's presidency in a new book of memoirs, his publishers announced on Monday. Despite being in the same party as the president, McCain has been one of Trump's most forceful critics over the last 2 years, both in the run-up to the 2016 election and its aftermath. Candid, pragmatic, always fascinating, John McCain holds nothing back in his latest memoir, which is titled The Restless Wave, will be released on May 22nd. Okay, here's what's going to be interesting on that. He wrote it with his longtime associate, Mark Salter, who's a very skilled person. But here's what's going to be interesting about this, the parts that criticize Donald Trump. This doesn't usually go so well for Republicans who write books, particularly Arizona Senator Republicans, Senate Republicans who write books condemning Donald Trump. And I credit one of our own Arizona Republic columnists, Robert Robb, for putting his finger specifically and well on this very point. First of all, before we get to what Robert Robb wrote, remember – what it was that had John McCain unendorse Donald Trump. And remember that John McCain did endorse, ultimately, Donald Trump once he was the nominee of the party. John McCain endorsed him, and then somewhere around October 8th when the Billy Bush tape came out, is that what we call it, the Billy Bush tape? When that came out, somewhere around the month before the election, John McCain, because of that tape, and he said so, withdrew his endorsement of Donald Trump. Kind of interesting. A friend of mine called me on this on a theory the other day, yesterday. I want to share with you and see if you think he's right about that. But we'll come back to that in a moment. John McCain withdraws his endorsement for Donald Trump. In other words, over a tape of Donald Trump with Billy Bush. Okay, so the unendorsement or the withdrawal of the endorsement is based on a character question, one might say, a character issue, better put, a character issue, or some evidence or further evidence of a character issue. It's not really on policy, in other words. It wasn't on policy. So now let's fast forward to Jeff Flake's critique of Donald Trump. First in the book, Conscience of a Conservative, named after the Barry Goldwater book, and then in a series of speeches he gave in New Hampshire and Washington about a week or so ago. Robert Robb writes in the Arizona Republic that Jeff Flake's criticisms of Donald Trump would be more apt and better well received and more consistent if they were actually about policy and not character. Here's what Robert Robb wrote in the Arizona Republic. Trump has governed very conservatively. He appointed mostly staunch conservatives to his cabinet, including to posts such as the FDA and the EPA that caused most Republican presidents to flinch. Most Republican presidents put in moderates there or Democrats. His judge selections, extending well beyond Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, couldn't be better from a conservative perspective. His rollbacks of Obama-era regulations gave a bounce to the economy, and again, they treaded on territory where many Republican presidents would have flinched. Although this columnist demurred, meaning Robb, most conservative economists agreed with the primacy Trump gave to a significant cut in the corporate income tax rate. Obamacare wasn't repealed, but its primary pillar, the individual mandate, was knocked out. And the Trump administration is doing everything it can to allow alternatives to Obamacare plans in the individual marketplace. That's a remarkably conservative first-year record. Well, I want to come back to Robert Robb's point and the McCain-Flake critique of Trump in a moment. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth and Chris Show. I'm Seth Leibson. Our phone number is 602-508-0960. Okay, so John McCain now has a book coming out, which in part is going to be a critique of Donald Trump. That would, of course, join Jeff Flake's speeches of late and his book critiquing President Trump. Robert Robb had a column in the Arizona Republic on Flake's critique of Donald Trump, which I think is really apt. He says when it comes to policy, Robert Robb does, Flake really only has two significant differences with Donald Trump. Flake believes in a generous immigration policy. Trump is an immigration restrictionist. Flake is a free trader. Trump a protectionist. But on immigration, Robb writes, it's Flake who's the outlier. One can reason from conservative principles to either immigration position, but there is no question that the majority sentiment in the Republican Party, particularly among primary voters, is on the more restrictionist side. That is perhaps most convincingly illustrated by the Senate's vote in favor of the so-called Gang of Eight immigration bill the Senate approved in 2013 and Flake co-authored. There were 68 yes votes, but only 14 of them were Republican. The vast majority of Senate Republicans, 32 of them, opposed Flake's immigration bill. Flake's real case against Trump, Robb writes, and I believe this will have to be McCain's, is how Trump behaves in office and on the campaign trail, but that is not an ideological critique. In his New Hampshire speech, Flake decried Trump's propaganda-fueled dystopian view of conservatism. That's a quote, propaganda-fueled dystopian view of conservatism. Rob writes, I prefer my conservatism sunny side up, a la Ronald Reagan and Jack Kemp. But disposition isn't an ideological dividing line. There are cheerful conservatives and grumpy ones, and there are cheerful liberals and grumpy ones. Hubert Humphrey, a stalwart liberal mistreated by 60s radicalism, was known as the happy warrior, the foremost protector of cheerful politics in Arizona today, he says, is Kyrsten Sinema, who is no conservative. Nor is nastiness alien to conservative politics and conservative success. Newt Gingrich was a practitioner of nasty politics in gaining Republican control of the House in 1994. In reality, nastiness is the norm in American politics. Reagan, Kemp, Humphrey, Sinema, and Flake, the exceptions. So as we get ready for this McCain book, I'm wondering where the differences are going to be that are different from Flake's critique, which are mostly going to be about things other than ideology and policy. And I think if they are, and if they aren't well documented as real differences of ideology and policy, it's going to fail. 602-508-0960. What are your thoughts? I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.